Hey listeners, this is Travis Book, bassist and singer in the bluegrass band The Infamous String Dusters. I started the Travis Book Happy Hour to try to get to the root of what makes my contemporaries tick, what inspires and motivates them, and why they make music. It's an hour where we get to play together, talk about life, and do it all in front of a live studio audience. If you haven't listened yet, maybe check out some of my highlights, including Sierra Hull, Beppe Gambetta, Tim O'Brien, and Lindsay Liu. You can find every episode of the Travis Book Happy Hour on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network or wherever you get podcasts.
Hi, and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians. It's me, Cindy House. I host this podcast. Thanks a lot for finding us. Before we get into our guest today, very excited to talk to Dom Flemons. I want to let you know that if you want to stay in touch, best way to do it is to sign up for our Basic Folk newsletter. It gets sent out monthly, and you can sign up at basicfolk.com or in the show notes. There's a link. There's also a link to make a financial contribution. You can give $5 a month, get a Basic Folk beanie, which are handmade knitted beanies that my mom hand knits. You can find those in the shop at basicfolk.com. You can also follow us on social media at Basic Folk Pod. All right. Dr. Dom Flemons comes off as older than his 40 years, and I think it's because he seems like he is of a different era. This is thanks in part to his work in teaching and interpreting such old songs, such as his work with Carolina Chocolate Drops that he was in alongside Rhiannon Giddens and Justin Robison. Originally from Phoenix, Dom is considered an expert player on the banjo, guitar, harmonica, jug, percussion, quills, fife, and rhythm bones. When he was 18 years old, he saw Dave Van Ronk in concert and was completely taken with the way Van Ronk told the stories and history behind the old songs he was playing in concert. From then on, Dom would also give the background of the songs he performed live, leading to much intense research for songs and their backstories. On his latest album, Traveling Wildfire, he began work on the album during the pandemic. He wanted to figure out a way to give the listener a way to process the world around them without being too didactic. Smarty pants. The record is filled with Dom's most personal songs about his family, history, and of course, interpretations of very old songs. We talk about all this and his strong outfit game, which I am sure no one is surprised by, that came up during the interview. We're going to take a listen to a song from his new album. This is Slow Dance With You, and then we'll get to our conversation with Dom Flemons on Basic Folk.
I wanna pull you close and slow dance with you. Darling, I ain't the perfect man, but I see the sun's coming up and you're lovely wrapped in dawn. Darling, take my hand.
Dr. Dom Flemons, thank you for joining me today. It's so nice to meet you.
Absolutely. Real pleasure. Thanks for having me on the program.
Okay, so I was surprised to find out that you and I are the same age. I'm actually older than you. And I think it seems like it's because like you seem like you're from like a different era because of your work in teaching and interpreting such old songs. I wanted to hear from you about how you feel about your age. Like, do you feel older than you are? And is that because of your work? And in what ways do you feel young?
Oh, I mean, in my mind, I'm still just as young as I've always been, you know. I started out to playing in shows and concerts back when I was 16. So I still think in the same way in a lot of ways, or at least I have the drive in my mind.
You feel like a 16-year-old?
Well, I have the drive, same drive and the same love of the music that I've had from the beginning. I think I'll just say it that way.
Oh, that's rare.
You know, yeah. So that's one thing. In terms of being old, I try not to think too hard about it. I don't try to be older than I am. But that's something that's on everybody else if they might think I'm a little bit older. But I don't really try to be older than you see me right now.
It just comes off naturally, I guess. It's funny when people meet me, like if they hear my voice on the radio or even like if they talk on the phone with me and then we meet in person, they always think that I'm going to be younger. So I know where you're coming from.
Right on.
In that way. You are originally from Phoenix and your family had been in Phoenix for 5 generations. You're of Black and Mexican descent. I also was delighted to learn that your mom was a flamenco dancer.
Yep.
Growing up, how did you feel connected to your Mexican roots and your Black roots in your family?
Well, I guess in my Mexican roots on my mom's side, that's kind of, we have a lot of members of the family on that side that are around. And so in many ways, I always felt very connected with them, and a lot of our dishes that we make at home in Phoenix, there a lot of Mexican dishes as well as American food. And then on my dad's side, I ended up going to college in the town where my dad grew up in Flagstaff, Arizona. So he comes from a mountaineer type of town that's also sort of a ski resort tourist place, and then also is the home of the university for Northern Arizona University. And so, I mean, one of the things that kept it all together was music. And my parents always had music playing of different sorts. They liked a lot of soul music, and so they were playing a lot of soul music around in the house.
What kind of Mexican dishes are we talking about?
We're talking mostly tacos, tostadas, calabacitas, menudo. Those are sort of the main ones, I guess, that I'd say, nachos and things like that. But yeah, mostly tacos and tostadas and menudo. I actually had my mom whipped up a pot when I was in Phoenix just recently.
Oh, wait, what is that last one?
Oh, menudo? Mm-hmm. Oh, menudo, it's a tripe and hominy soup. So it's kind of like this, it's a real interesting combination of corn and what would you say? It's a honeycomb tripe is what it has in it. And
ooh.
And it sort of is like, I guess the dish I'd find somewhat the same as in Vietnamese food. They have pho. Menudo is similar in the way that it's sort of smaller pieces that traditionally were the lesser desired parts of the animal, but a soup tradition was born out of that, and you sort of build your broth as you go along when you make menudo as well. You put in salsa and cilantro, green onions. Mm-hmm.
Do you speak Spanish?
No, I never learned how to speak Spanish fully. I took 2 years in school, but I was part of the generation that just didn't grow up with speaking Spanish in the household. My mom did, and my Nana, of course, but never in the household when we were growing up.
But if they were speaking to each other, could you get what they were saying?
I can get around it. You know, I always had a lot of Mexican friends, too, that when I go to their family's houses, they'd speak it. And then also, once I studied Latin as well, I found that I was able to grasp a lot of the concepts around romantic languages in a certain way, since they all derive from the same root.
Funny. I was talking to the folk singer Chris Smither, and I think he speaks a few different languages, and he was talking about how he's like, once you like what you were saying about Latin, like once you grasp at what the language is actually doing, you're able to like work through it and stuff. But
yeah,
I am trying to learn Spanish and I'm not very good at it.
Yeah, it's quite a jump to be able to functionally use it and bring it into the day-to-day work environment. That's always been the problem for me. I just never found myself in a situation where I was only speaking Spanish.
Right, right. We need immersion, Dom.
Maybe one day that 6 month trip to Spain or might come up, or Cuba, or one of the great Spanish speaking nations.
You're considered an expert player on the banjo, guitar, harmonica, jug, percussion, quills, fife, and rhythm bones. That's listed on the internet in a couple different places. What instrument did you start with? And then also, what was the first instrument you connected with, and how did that connection change your relationship to playing music?
Oh, I guess that would start with the first instrument. I had a practice drum pad that I had first, so I started out in percussion and drumming. And when I was about 16, you know, years ago, that that was when I began to play the guitar, and I started to see the way that the guitar could serve as both a percussion instrument as well as a melodic instrument and a chord-based instrument. So after having played drums from, I don't know, say fifth grade all the way through high school, I found myself with a little beat-up acoustic guitar, and I started to learn songs from there. I was always fascinated by the old-time ballads, country blues, music of Bob Dylan or Eric Anderson or some of the famous folk singers. And at that time, it was before there was a full-scale resurgence of vinyl record collecting. So a lot of my early experiences when it came to picking up music came from finding records in old junk stores or meeting people who knew the repertoire in one way or another. And Arizona is always a very transient town, especially when I was in Flagstaff. I came across a lot of different musicians who played in these different styles, and I would take my notes and try to do what I could to learn a little bit about them. And until 2005, and that was when I left Arizona after finishing college and started my musical career in earnest.
You have a huge affinity for libraries, I feel.
Oh, yeah.
Especially when it comes to researching and discovering music. What has been your relationship to libraries, and how has that evolved?
Well, the library is one of the great sources for source texts, of course, but also for music. You know, having come of age in the year 2000, I was able to inherit all of the benefits of the new wave of the new millennium coming in. And one of the ways they did it at my public library in Phoenix was that they created a huge CD section in which you could check out 10 CDs at a time. So I found myself checking out hundreds of CDs because I would just get 10 at a time, and just over a period of time, I would listen to a lot of different types of music. And that would also dovetail into the video section of the library, where they had DVDs of documentaries like Ken Burns Jazz, for example, was one example where I'd get to hear about all these wonderful musicians. And then I could go to the CD stacks and I could find CDs by all these wonderful musicians like Jelly Roll Morton or Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Charles Mingus, another Arizona native. And that sort of set me on a trajectory of expanding my musical vocabulary.
So it was all kind of the old music that you were checking out. You weren't checking out Green Day, Dookie, or Sublime.
In some ways, I was always drawn to older music because I found that there was so much of it, for one. I just only found a few bands very interesting when I was growing up, you know, like I listened to maybe like a group, like I'd listen to Green Day or I'd listen to Sublime or, you know, a couple of other rock acts here and there. But I found myself always interested in the oldies station with the 60s and 70s music and the 50s music. So that was really my first love, is like doo-wop, Chuck Berry, Fats Domino, Carl Perkins, then there was the Beatles, the Zombies, 13 Floor Elevators, you know, all the while, I never was in rock bands like a lot of my contemporaries. I was always an solo acoustic act playing this music as well, so doing rock and roll but on an acoustic guitar. And so I always played as a solo. And over time, as I began to start reading about different types of music, I found that there were influences that preceded each of these different performers. You know, so like from Bob Dylan, you can find out about Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger. You can find out about Bob Dylan's contemporaries like Phil Oakes or Tom Paxton or Eric Anderson. And so for me, it was a combination of first searching these albums out, and then also when the library couldn't provide what I wanted, I had to go to the local record stores, and I built a little network of record stores which I would always visit and see if I could find all the records I was looking for. So just always had that love for music and the search for great music in my heart.
Yeah, you are a very intense researcher, whether you're at the library learning from a master player, digging through the record bin. How would you describe your research process? And then more importantly, where do you think your talent for acquiring knowledge came from?
Well, I guess my method for research, it's a little different for every type of project I might be doing. Some projects require a full comprehensive search into all information about said subject. Like a few years back, I did an article called Can You Blame Gus Cannon, which was about the banjo player Gus Cannon. Did that for the Oxford American. And I was writing an article about a song that he had written that was satiring the very infamous meeting of Theodore Roosevelt and Booker T. Washington in the White House in 1900. And so for a article like that, I needed to find all recorded sources that I could find that talked about Booker T. Washington. Then I had to read bios of both of the gentlemen, Booker T. Washington as well as Theodore Roosevelt, and kind of see where the fact match against the fiction of the song.
Would you read more than one bio, or just one each?
I'll read as many as I can get my hands on if I got the time for it, you know. But for me, there were a couple of great books that sort of touched upon the sort of journey that each of these gentlemen went down. And then, of course, I have to translate this from this historical event here into the satire that is the song Can You Blame the Colored Man, as recorded by Gus Cannon in 1927. And also giving context for what Gus Cannon was doing at that time, how Gus Cannon is relevant as a banjo player. And then, of course, he made recordings in the early 1960s, so he's well known for his song Walk Right In. So there are a couple of different pathways that have to be explored just to get to the article itself and get to the meat of the research. Other things are a little bit more less demanding. Such as a couple years back, I wrote an essay for Tyler Childers' album Long Violent History, and just being able to condense a lot of the history of black and white musical interchange in Kentucky in sort of a few words, like 1,000 words or so, that's a different type of research, because then I don't have to go quite into every single detail about said subject. In this one, it was Kentucky music, string band music, and how it connected with ragtime and blues, and that I can have an essay like that. Another one is the most recent, actually, is the album Birthright, a Black Roots Music Compendium, which came out on Concord Records, and so I did an essay for that. And how I wanted to approach that one was I wanted to give people a sense that for more than a century, we've had black music recordings available to us, first by folkloric means, and then later on through independent record labels who were willing to take non-commercial music and turn it into something that can be listened for posterity by future generations. So I really wanted to break away from what didn't happen and move it into a conversation of what has happened. And so for an essay like that, that was very important, because it's a wonderful 2-disc set, covers a lot of ground, and several generations, I'd say about 5 or 6 generations of people that were playing all of these songs, whether it be from Reverend Gary Davis, who was born in the late 1800s, to Cedric Burnside or myself, who were about the same age. And we inherited traditions. Compared to these earlier generations, they inherited a different part of the tradition. So just trying to trying to tease those things out. That's where a lot of my research tends to focus on, is because in the 21st century, there are a lot of people who don't know the stories that were just being told in the atmosphere when I was starting out. Because when I became a professional, a lot of the folklorists and scholars and musicians that represented the 60s folk revival or 70s folk revival, they were all living and they were all very active. And so I found that over time, you know, there has to be someone who continues to tell the story no matter what, so that people can continue to sing or appreciate the songs.
You've talked about when you were first playing out, you were impersonating the sounds and voices of the people you were covering. You did an example of this on your video for the guitar workshop. It's a real wild ride where you did imitations like all in a row, Bob Dylan, then Howlin' Wolf, then Charlie Patton. You are really awesome at impressions, which I feel like has to translate in other aspects of your life. But like, when did you realize your impression talent, and how did that ability help you eventually develop your own style?
Well, I guess one of the easy answer to it is that the more that you know, the more you can use at your disposal. And so for me, music is a language, it's a vocabulary. And I think this also kind of falls into my own study as an English major and studying ancient literature and understanding that there are dialects and that there are turns of phrases that define literature. And then when we're talking about music making, there are moments like to have that sort of low voice, if you hear me howling, you know, that's a distinctive sound that defines Howlin' Wolf's music. Beside him, the chords or the music or the rhythm, there's a uniqueness of the voice. And so I found that with most folk singers, they all had very distinctive voices. And that was one thing that drew me to every performer I've ever listened to, is they had a distinctive sounding voice. And at first, I guess when I was young, of course, you're unsure of your own voice. And so for me, I always tried to use somebody else's voice to get come across, because it's comedy in one way, because if you're a fan and I'm a fan, and then I do something that sounds like the record, we can both laugh at the idea that we both know this inside joke. And so that was somewhere where I started, because of course I was playing in coffee houses where, as I always like to remind people, like students, is that where, you know, at a coffee house or out on the street busking, nobody has to do anything for you, and no one has to care about the music you're playing. So you can play well, but you also must be compelling to the person you're trying to reach. And so part of the vocal impersonations, the vocal contortionism, grew out of that need to have a different way of performing that is separate from my own personal repertoire. It also made it more interesting for me, too, because I get to sing my favorite records. So it was also somewhat of a selfish venture, too, to be able to showcase for people something that was a part of my heart.
I also was thinking about how you must crack up your daughter all the time. Like, you must be such a funny dad.
I try my best. She loves her daddy, and so it's been good to you know, now she's starting to be able to sit down and really we're able to really have story time now, and so I'm starting to get a chance to do some more of the reading and really getting a chance to, you know, have her participate. So she's funny. She cracks me up, though. She was if you can imagine, she knows about every word to the album Traveling Wildfire. And one of the things she did that cracked me up, that actually affected the way the record now sounds, is when I first started playing back Slow Dance With You, she, at the time, she was about 4 years old, and she started singing that chorus in the back seat, and she almost had all of the words by the first time I played it. And I thought to myself, now, if this little girl at 4 years old can almost recite this song, it's not only a brilliant song with a simple surface to it, but it has a beautiful little melody. I knew this had to be the very first song on the record. And so, yeah, she cracks me up all the time, though.
Oh, that's great. Talking about the history of the songs you perform on stage is like a staple of your live shows, like telling the history and the stories behind them. This is something you were inspired to do after you saw Dave Van Ronk when you were 18 years old perform at a coffee house and were quite moved by his storytelling. Since then, you've incorporated that element into your sets. How do you see knowing the context of music enhancing to a listening experience?
Well, sometimes songs can be elliptical. They don't have to be direct, and they can also talk about emotions without giving you a storyline from point A to B. And one of the things that I've always appreciated when I've heard live recordings of musicians is when they tell a little bit about the song, and they just tell you a little story. It doesn't have to be a lot necessarily, but it actually can really enhance the entire experience when you know that a song was written about a certain person or written about a certain time in one's life, or if it's a very poetic song, sometimes the artist can reveal, you know, the extra secrets that the audience just has to wonder, well, was he talking about this or was he talking about that? And that's another way that stories can really open up the spectrum. For me as well, once I saw Van Ronk and I saw the way that he was able to incorporate interesting stories for people who are also fans of the music. Like when I first saw him, he had a story about Reverend Gary Davis. That was his own unique experience. And that can't be repeated by anyone else. And so even for me, as I've gone along, as I've had stories of folks like my old friend Boo Hanks, who's no longer with us, I find myself referencing back to those times when he and I worked together, and I can share pieces of information that are a unique part of my musical experience. Or even like Joe Thompson, the old-time fiddler. I was the one that drove him home after all of those gigs that we used to do way back. And so he and I just talked about any old thing. So there are a lot of conversations that I was able to bring up that went beyond the written material that I had read before meeting him. I'm specifically thinking of African Banjo Echoes in Appalachia by Dr. Cecilia Conway, or the Black Banjo Songsters of North Carolina and Virginia. Those two albums have a lot of information about Joe, but getting a chance to ride with him in the car, you know, he told me about how he used to see Blind Boy Fuller at the tobacco auctions in Durham, North Carolina. And it was very much his own story telling, you know, a first person account of seeing an old time blues singer from the 1920s. And I mean, that's that sort of stuff you live to be able to hear those stories. Or or when it came to the album for Traveling Wildfire, he was the one that I asked him about the song Tough Luck, because in the Black Banjo Songsters album, they mentioned the song Tough Luck in passing. And so I had a chance to ask Joe about it, and he kind of filled me in on a little bit of information on that song, which eventually, years later now, has made its way onto the new album.
The way that you strum your guitar or your banjo, I feel like it's pretty unusual. Like, your right hand, your strumming hand, almost like floats when you're doing the down and the up strums. I don't play guitar, by the way, but it seems like I'm watching something like pretty important and historical when I see you play an instrument, even the bones, the clacky bones. No one can see this, but I'm like making clam gestures with my hands. Anyways, what do you make of like the history in how you play an instrument?
Well, one of the things I like to do is I like to think about what I know about the song and its time and its place and its space. And when you start to really think about it, again, thinking about music as a language or a vocabulary, once you begin to know about the time and a place a song was set, you can submerge your own ego into really helping the song come across better. In many ways, it's like how when people interpret Shakespeare, there are classes you can take to do that. My class for country blues was being in North Carolina and being out in the rural South, playing at people's feet. But there are ways that you can think about the song and trying to just serve the song to make it the best it can be. I mean, me, I commit to it. I don't assume that any of my songs sound too old-fashioned or old or non-relevant. So when I'm playing them, they're just as relevant now as they were sometimes 100 years ago. And so that's kind of the way I've always approached it, where I don't put a seed of doubt in the audience's mind about the relevance.
In thinking about the time that you came of age, me as well, like in the 90s and early 2000s, and also in like your initial musical discovery period, and thinking of like when you were a teenager and pre-college, I imagine a lot of the artists that you were coming across were men. So when did you first come to realize the importance of, and also the strife of, women in music?
That's a good question. Let me think. The first time I really started to think about women performers, I was actually watching a documentary film called Jazz on a Summer's Day, and there's a great performance by Dinah Washington and Anita Day on this film. And that was when I began to think about women musicians in the jazz field. I guess the first time I became aware of The Strife came from one of my dear friends, Peggy Seeger, and her album Different Therefore Equal, which features the song I'm Gonna Be an Engineer. And once I heard that, I felt like it was very important from that point on for me.
What's the basis of that song?
I'm Gonna Be an Engineer basically runs through a single woman's life and the different ways that when she's born, she says, I'm gonna be an engineer, like a train engineer. So she's walking around with her corduroys and has her engineer's hat on, but everybody says you can't because girls can't be engineers. So then she sort of lets everyone tell her how she should live her life. So she joins the typing pool. She then has a husband. Then she has kids. And then all of a sudden, because of a recession, her husband gets laid off. And then now, at the last verse, she gets to be an engineer, just like she always wanted. But she then finds out she's not given equal pay. So then the boss says, you know, I only hired you because I can't afford a man. And so she goes back through her whole life and says, I've heard all of these things, and but I'm gonna fight this not as I'm gonna fight it as a woman, not a lady, and fight it as an engineer. And so it sort of is a very uplifting story overall. And also she's playing great guitar on it, and lyrically. It's just a masterpiece of a song. But that was when I first became aware of some of the strife that that women have dealt with throughout time and history. And, of course, you know, the work of getting into the Beatles and John Lennon. Of course, I got into a lot of the solo work of John Lennon, which is very influenced by Yoko Ono's presence. And so songs like Mind Games, for example, are songs that I've always kept very close to me, especially when I think about love and partnership and the relationships of men and women. And of course, in my musical career, I've worked with a lot of women as well. Always trying to push material. For example, like I've always been a fan of the vaudeville blues singers, Ma Rainey, Bessie Smith. Then of course there are the lesser knowns, which are like Alberta Hunter, Ethel Waters, Elza D. Robinson is one of my favorites with a really snappy name too. And all of these women recorded between 1920 and 1925, and nobody covers any of this material. And so even in my own work in the Chocolate Drops, a lot of that vaudeville blues that we were able to get through, Rhiannon would record a couple of those songs, but those were things I was always pushing, and I still push them for any time someone wants a great song.
I read a bit about, is it Sule Greg Wilson? Is that how you say his name?
Oh, yeah, Sule Greg Wilson, that's right.
Sule Greg Wilson, a percussionist, banjo player, and folklorist that you met in Flagstaff. And he became a mentor to you. You were in Sankofa Strings together along with Rhiannon Giddens.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about the importance of mentorship in your life? And then also, what have you learned about being a mentor?
Mm. Well, mentorship is a wonderful, it's a wonderful part of a musician's development, because you're able to sort of take the pressure off of your own self. You know, singer-songwriters, it's a very introspective process. It's a very, in your head sort of a phenomenon to write the songs. But with mentorship, especially when doing traditional music, it's great because you get a chance to connect with people on the songs. And with traditional music, one of the things I liked about it was it had no instant gratification. You had to wait until you got it right. And you only knew that you got it right when your mentor would finally say, you've got it. And you just have to wait for that time. And sometimes it can be an excessively long period where you're just struggling.
Sounds like from experience you know that.
Well, yeah. I had never played clawhammer banjo before I left Arizona. I had developed a style of banjo playing that was my own. But when I went to North Carolina, I had to learn how to do clawhammer, and it required a whole different set of muscles to play in the clawhammer style. It's part of the reason why my guitar style has so many flips and turns, is because I'm using guitar techniques as well as banjo techniques that are different from bluegrass banjo, also old-time clawhammer banjo. But when I met Sule Greg Wilson back in Arizona, he was looking for black banjo players to be a part of the event, the Black Banjo Gathering, that happened in 2005. And so in a lot of ways, we connected over this desire to help expand the scholarship of black banjo. Because at that time, the African banjo was sort of, it was hidden in plain sight. No one had ever 100% denied that there was an African banjo tradition or a Caribbean banjo tradition. But the examples were so few and far between that it would give one the impression that there wasn't a lot of information out there. Nowadays, we have a lot more information in front of us, and people can see that the banjo has an African-Caribbean root, and we can see that African-Americans and banjo playing are a piece of a much wider banjo tradition that goes, that's a world tradition. But at that time in 2005, there just wasn't a lot of information. So when I met Sule, he had spent 25 years working on black banjo and blues scholarship and study in his own house. So then I grabbed my study stuff, and we would just, you know, convene at his house and spend hours talking about the relevance of different movements, different styles, different ways of playing, and how they translate into our modern sense of music, you know, because you can find the roots of funk, the roots of hip hop and rap all within the string band music. It takes a little bit to be able to hear all of those sounds, but it's wrapped up within the big spectrum, because, you know, all black music, it's born out of the rhythm of life that must survive and sustain you. And so that's something that Sule and I talked about a whole bunch. And by the time I ended up going out to North Carolina, he'd allowed me to burn a lot of CDs that he had picked up over time that were very, very helpful CDs as I went along.
Yeah, you did end up moving to North Carolina. And then you, Rhiannon, and Justin Robison formed the Carolina Chocolate Drops, which was a huge deal for folk music. And thanks to the Chocolate Drops, I feel like all of a sudden people were learning about the banjo's African roots, both white and black people alike. So I don't know if this is a lame question or not. Like, some people don't like to talk about this, but back then there was like a struggle to get in front of a black audience playing this type of music. That was 18 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So now, nearly two decades later, how have you seen that evolve?
Well, again, I try to make my music without putting too many pretenses on top of it. So I feel like the black part of my music is well represented within what I'm presenting. So that doesn't sway no matter who's in the audience. And so I think at first, you know, one thing to always remember is that we were in the folk music field. And one thing that I considered it when I came into it was that it wasn't going to be a full all black audience. So I never tried to fight against the audience that would show up. But what I did find is over time, as the music became more part of the curriculum that people were learning, I found more people starting to show up. And over the past 20 years, I feel that there are quite a few people of color that are in the audience nowadays, more so than beforehand. And I think a lot of that is where we were, you know, we were planting the seeds to really find a foundational structure for the study of African-American string band music. And so that was something that I was always focused on. So coming into it, I didn't really try to think of things as, okay, all black audience, all white audience. I sort of took it exactly as it was. And then over time, I found that the seeds have sown what we were able to put out there. Yeah, because it was really a struggle, because you have to imagine, people couldn't imagine that a black banjo player could exist. And that's what we were struggling with. So our fight was, showing that a banjo player could be a black banjo player or a white banjo player. And so that's more of what we were fighting, more so than having to redirect the audience. And so nowadays, younger people as well as people of color can now see that a black banjo player is not the exception to the rule, but is part of the whole rule. And so that's kind of what we had to, that's what was our struggle when we were playing as the Chocolate Drop. So that was kind of what we did, and we were able to find a lot of success in that because people were really starved for it.
You are famously known as the American Songster, and I read this like on one of your Facebook comments that you're always glad to tell the history of the music that your repertoire covers. However, Dom, I wonder if it's hard to be a black man talking about this history. So I'm thinking of your contributions to that viral video about Lil Nas X getting taken off the country music charts because it wasn't considered quote unquote country music. So like, how protective are you of this knowledge, and how protective are you of yourself when sharing context for such hotly contested debates?
Well, at the end of the day, the facts speak for themselves. And so I keep that in mind whenever I come into play in any situation. Also, I try to make sure not to just jump into situations that I may not know about, because that's also a thing, too, is that you can believe something about music, but sometimes your belief, which could be from hearsay or from things that you've heard, may not be the full truth. And so I've always tried to make sure that whatever I'm commenting on, I'm telling the whole truth and nothing but the truth. And that served me well in that way. When it came to like Lil Nas X, I found it to be the beginning of a interesting phenomenon that came on with the rebirth of the black cowboy in popular culture. Now, I spent 10 years working on an album called Black Cowboys, 2 years of actually making this thing, but about 10 years worth of research. And one of the things that I didn't want to do is I didn't want to spend a lot of time on the black Hollywood cowboy. I have a couple of references in the liner notes, but I wanted to focus on the working class cowboys and the history of the migration of black people after slavery going into the 1960s, because I felt like many people have an uncle, an aunt, a grandparent, or a great-grandparent who understood this whole history, and I wanted to sort of invigorate that aspect of black culture, because I felt like it was just right below the level, the level of consciousness for a lot of people. A lot of people would say, I'm not sure about black cowboys, but when you start to see pictures, just like with me, I personally had the same response. All of a sudden, my grandparents' story of growing up in Arkansas and Texas and making their way to Arizona, all of a sudden it wasn't such a foreign story anymore. And they weren't necessarily cowboys like we would think, just cowboys, but black Western people moving out west and building a new life. That was what I wanted to convey to people in Dom Flemings Presents Black Cowboys. Now, it's interesting because Lil Nas X sort of came in at this one juncture where you had the idea of black cowboys being out there, but also black country music coming into play. So I played with the idea a little bit on the album of having country and western music that had a black feel, like Lonesome Old River Blues was an experiment into that. A Roy Acuff number, and we kind of did, you know, kind of gave him a nice bluesy a bluesy sound on top of that song. But with Lil Nas X, he opened up a new chapter in the black cowboys and black country music story, where you have a full incorporation of hip-hop and rap into black rural music. Because black country is country and western, like Charlie Pride, but then there's also black rural people, which is also where the black string band story tends to overlap. And so black rural people all of a sudden pushed back and said, they wanted this type of music. They wanted Old Town Road to be their representation of their community or culture, or they just wanted to rock out to country music that sounded like that. And that's something that it's hard to be able to anticipate a big hit like that. But for me, I don't try to be protective about my history because you can find it anywhere. I make sure that the history is, some of it is common knowledge, but I don't tend to hold top secret information in my back pocket for a lot of my history. So when it came to Lil Nas X, especially once Billy Ray Cyrus joined in, instead of it just being a hip hop infused black country and western cowboy song, now with Billy Ray Cyrus, you have a black white duet, which has been done many times, especially in the 1990s and up into the present. There have been a lot of black and white duets all the way through country music history. And so I just answered all the questions they asked me accordingly when asked about the song. When it comes to the Billboard charts, I mean, there's only so much you can do with certain things, but I'm glad that the controversy helped him out more than it diminished him.
The new album, Traveling Wildfire. So in the press release, it says, Traveling Wildfire, the musician and scholar turns inward, facing the highs and lows of his years on the road as he brings his own songwriting prowess to the forefront. You have never released such personal songs before. So let's talk about vulnerability. Like, how vulnerable was this process for you? And if at all, how did your scholarly background impact your ability to open up with these songs?
That's a good question. Now, for vulnerability, a lot of my music, I tend to keep the music very up-tempo. It's one of the things that's kept me, that sustained me for a long
time. No one can tell what's going on.
Yeah, you know.
It's all up tempo.
Yeah, and that's one of the things is over the past several years, you know, I'm in a specialized type of music that I'm going against the dance music of the day. So up tempo is a way that it's very easy to be able to just let an album just fly right by you. And so that's what I've done for the past couple of records. For this one, I started reaching into my old notebooks to see if there were songs that I had written that could use a revamp, because I've put out so many albums now. I just wanted to do something and say, I'm not going to try to do anything too structured. I'm not going to try to do anything conceptual like Black Cowboys, but I want to reach into my own heart about it. And so like a song like Slow Dance With You, I had written that one quite a few years ago, and I always thought it was a good country number. But I had never had a moment in which to play it on stage because, of course, when playing old-timey music, the audience also would like you to stay in playing old-timey music. So a song like Slow Dance With You never felt appropriate in my shows. And so I finally pulled that one out. And then another song, let's say It's Cold Inside. That's another one. I was in a kind of a rough spot when I did that one. I had just left the group there, my first marriage broke up. I was in a real tough spot when it came to how I was living, and that one I wrote sort of within that period, and I sort of just set it in the notebook because I didn't want to get too far down into the deep dungeon of my heart, not at that time. And so Traveling Wildfire, it seemed like a proper song, and I wanted to be able to give it a new life and a new approach. And then also, these two songs probably wouldn't have made it onto the record if the pandemic hadn't come in the way it had and hadn't extended out so long. Because I started to start checking in with friends of mine, and I started to see that they were all having a tough time too, and that the past couple years were really rough for everybody. And so I found It's Cold Inside sort of took a sort of a different turn when I started to think of the lyrics again, because it to me related to a lot of people who are out there in the world that were having a tough time. You know, they're holding face, you know, but at the same time still having a rough time. So there was stuff like that. I did write one song to my wife in Dark Beauty, and I wanted it to be somewhat of a sequel to Black Cowboys in a way. Like it start the song Black Woman starts off the Black Cowboys album, and I kind of wanted to do a sequel to it and also delve into the futuristic cowboy stuff that that I didn't really focus on my album Black Cowboys. So that's where stuff like Nobody Wrote It Down and then also Saddle It Around sort of fell into play on those particular songs.
Okay, I have a question about Nobody Wrote It Down. That song finds you studying the genealogy of Black migration and movement from slavery to the Buffalo Soldiers, Pony Express riders, cowboys, and Pullman porters on trains. And in that essay that you wrote for Tyler, you said one of the most amazing aspects of learning traditional Southern string band music is that in the most ideal situation, it is not written down.
Mm-hmm.
It is played until it is correct. Interesting juxtaposition. So in thinking about that, what is your perspective on what got written down versus what didn't get written down?
Oh, well, I mean, not enough got written down. You'll find, no matter what, not enough was ever written down. And that's one of the sad things that you find is that for whatever reason, sometimes it's not even malicious. It's even, stuff isn't written down because the materials and the knowledge nor the forethought to capture things for posterity just weren't there, you know? And that's one of the things that makes that song, Nobody Wrote It Down, so interesting is that it just captures just a little glimpse. And that's one of the things that made that so intriguing in the songwriting process with Carl Gustafson and Billy Branch, who co-wrote the song with me, is that it just gives you just a little taste, you know. And even the Pullman porter, I mean, he's saving a woman where the boiler blows and there's fire that's coming at her. And then it turns into this really action packed sequence that nobody wrote down, you know, and it just sort of settles itself into that. When it came to the Tyler record, one of the things that was so amazing to witness was that Tyler Childers hadn't been playing the fiddle all that long when he started that album. He had only been playing for about half a year because I believe he had a collarbone injury or something. And
that would be tough.
And so he was playing the fiddle a little bit.
Here.
Yeah, so he was just starting to play the fiddle, and he sounded so good playing along with Jesse Wells. That was one of the reasons I ended up writing that line, is because if I didn't tell you he was a beginning fiddler, that album would give you no indication that he was still very new to the fiddle. Because it sounds correct. It sounds like it's powerful music no matter what. And so that's one of the things that makes string band music so exciting in many ways, is because it's a democratic music. And also, you can have a musician who is very good at just a few things, and they can make a whole world of music out of just a few simple tricks or simple licks that are, when well placed, make all the difference.
You began working on the album Traveling Wildfire during the pandemic, and you wanted to figure out a way to give the listener a way to process the world around them without being too didactic. Very good vocabulary word. Dom, you are a very, very smart person, and I'm wondering how hard it is for you to have your brain and have the knowledge you have while still being accessible to others.
Well, you know, let me think how to say this. Because I started out busking on the streets before I had my full education and everything like that, I'm always reminded of the humbleness of connecting to people on the street and meeting people eye to eye right at the ground level. So I've never lost that whenever I've gone out into any musical venture. And so I try to keep that in mind when I meet anybody, whether it's someone that's way famous, way, way more famous than me, or if it's someone that is just a person that's walking up and saying hello. I try to at least be conscious of what a human being how they would like to be treated. And, you know, it's this just the golden rule in that way. I also take a step back in a lot of conversations because I want to hear what other people have to say. And sometimes it can be easy to overrule a conversation if you just spout off everything that you've done, or you try to get everything said that you've ever done leading up to it.
Or you're like the actually guy. Actually?
Exactly. Yeah. And I just have always tried to not really be that type of guy just because, you know, that's just my personality. But also, I like giving everybody else the floor. That's also when you see me collaborating with other musicians, I do that too. I let them have their time, and I get my time, and I always try to be real democratic about that stuff.
How do you say your wife's name?
Oh, Vania.
Vania Kennard.
Yeah, that's it.
You have such an adorable family, and she plays a big role in the behind the scenes of your music. She's also co-hosting with you on your radio show. She seems really rad. What's it been like to incorporate her into the business side of your career?
Well, it's been great. I'll say it that way in a single word. But when I met her, we met at Millennium Center, the Millennium Stage over at Washington, D.C. at a Lead Belly tribute concert. And she didn't really know much about Lead Belly, and I was the one who was hosting the program. And of all people, the headliner that night was Robert Plant and Alison Krauss. And so Robert Plant invited everybody out to dinner. And then I happened to meet Vania at the dinner table. Met her at the dinner table. And we exchanged numbers. And then we went out on a date a couple weeks afterward. And it was just love at first sight, you know. And also, she comes from a very strong political background. She was working with working as a part of Barack Obama's like presidential campaign in 2012, and has done a lot of really amazing work with in her capacity for her job. And so when she told me the type of work she was doing and she was thinking about getting out of politics, I told her that she should just come on the road with me. I said, you know, you're not going to make the same type of money, but you'll at least get to travel the world. And so she said,
have
yes.
Have you considered folk music?
Yeah. And so she said, yes. You know, again, the first time I had her over, she asked me, she said, would you like me to help you organize your records? And I said, yes, this is it. This is it. And she's great when it comes to co-hosting the radio show as well. She's bringing a great perspective in. Also on Traveling Wildfire, she was she helped curate the design of the album. We had a wonderful artist, Marina Martinez, working on the album art, and Vania was helping guide the way we focused on the way that the product would come out all together. And then, of course, she's a part. She's in the moon, so you get to see her.
Oh,
in the
I
moon.
Was wondering who's in the moon. Oh, yeah. I love it.
And yeah, that's a beautiful wet plate collodion tintype we have of her, and we imposed it into the moon. So I'm actually singing to her on the album cover.
Stop it! That's so cute. Okay, the Dom Flemons imagery is strong. The outfits, and I would say even your speaking voice, are quite striking. What has been the evolution of your presentation, your style of dress, and your style of speaking, and then how did you land on what you landed on?
Well, I guess the first thing I started to think of, because again, at my age and your age as well, being a part of the forefront of the new millennium, there was, you know, Y2K was a part of that time. And coming out of the 90s were sort of a upending of traditional values or traditional imagery. And then the 2000s was sort of a space where people were wanting to break away from the traditional mold of business, which of course then bled right into Facebook and social media and all those things in the years that passed. But for
Apple
me,
Music too. Yeah.
Yeah, and Apple Music. And so it sort of, things changed very quickly from 2000 to 2005 to now we're getting to 2023. I was always a big fan of silent film. And so iconography is the whole premise around silent film. And I particularly was a fan of Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton, Fritz Lang, and his movies like Metropolis and all of those old silent films. So I was always drawn to that sort of imagery. And when I began to learn the music of the 1920s and 30s, I started to try to juxtapose those images next to each other so that you could find a distinctive look or a distinctive feature that would define what I was presenting. Just like Charlie Chaplin was the little tramp. And even if you've never heard of who Charlie Chaplin is or the little tramp, if you've seen that little character, he's so distinctive with the little coat and the hat and the little mustache and the cane. Or there was another guy, Harold Lloyd, who had a big hat, kind of like the one that I wear, and big round glasses. And that was sort of, that was something that I found very appealing. And as I began to read about these directors, they began to talk about the way that at the time you had to have one distinctive feature that everybody could catch on to, and it would come back again and again. And so for me, it was plaid shirts. And then I ended up putting these suspenders on as a way to be able to just accentuate the color. And then that was sort of where it went from there. You know, there was a group as well called the Kingston Trio, that they also wore striped shirts. So that was their big thing, was striped shirts. And basically one of the things functionally of why they picked these striped shirts was that you could find them very easily at any men's clothing store. And the same thing with the plaid, I can find these at any clothing store. So they have some outrageous colors, and I've experimented with those colors for quite a while, because I never was much of a guy to wear a three-piece suit, nor was I the Hawaiian shirt guy or the or the Chuck Berry shirt. You'll have to look up Chuck Berry in the 70s, but the Chuck Berry shirt, I never could pull off the real outrageous shirts. So this was kind of where I landed here.
Do you do your own own shopping and styling? So you've done it all.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And even my hat, here is a brand of hat called an Akubra, and I picked this up in Australia at a little shop over by in a place called Katoomba. And this little hat is an Australian cowboy hat, but the way that the crown is built is almost like a pork pie hat. And I used to wear a pork pie hat all the time. And I realized when I found this Akubra hat, I knew that it'd be a very unique piece of my regalia. But also it also is a symbol of where I've gone, having gone to Malaysia and Australia and all over the world performing the music. It also gives me just a little piece of that traveling.
It'd probably be fun to go shopping with, like, vintage store shopping with you. Yeah. Or all around the world, you and Vania.
Oh yeah, that'd be wonderful. we'll have to get the funding on that one together.
Okay, great. You write a grant.
Yeah.
Shopping trip with Cindy from Basic Folk. This episode of Basic Folk was produced by John Nungesser. Alex Stanton composes our music. Basic Folk is on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. You can find all of our episodes there, wherever you get podcasts. You can search for us on the SiriusXM app under Basic Folk, or you can check out our website, basicfolk.com. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time. Bye.